A couple of stories published by Reuters over the past few weeks have documented the increased scrutiny that Russian hypersonic missile specialists have faced from their own government. And on May 24th, it was divulged that the director of the Siberian Christianovich Institute of Theoretical and Applied Mechanics has been arrested on suspicion of treason alongside two of his colleagues. Russian security services have accused them of sharing hypersonic missile technologies with China. This is interesting for a few reasons, among them the fact that Russia has been nudged more deeply into China's orbit over the past few years, that nudging growing into a bit of a push after Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine, with all the economic and military consequences that triggered in relatively short order. But it's also interesting because hypersonic missiles have been heralded by some as a disruptive technology that could, if used appropriately, completely shift power dynamics in some of the most strategically vital and tense regions around the world. Case in point, the deployment of hypersonic missiles along the Chinese coast, overlooking the hotly contested South China Sea, could, in theory, render many of the West's defenses in this area impotent. It could also make bringing aircraft carriers and other expensive hard targets within range a questionable decision, as the anti-missile defenses that would typically protect such things from most outside assaults would again, in theory, be unable to defend against this type of missile. Worth highlighting, too, is that if China does ever decide to invade Taiwan to bring it into its governmental fold, it's expected the West and its Pacific allies would attempt to bring this sort of firepower within range of China, so hypersonic missile technology could, conceivably at least, make such an invasion more likely and more likely to be successful. The reason hypersonic missiles have been heralded as potentially disruptive is that they move just incredibly fast. They're capable of carrying payloads up to 10 times the speed of sound, which makes intercepting them in the typical fashion all but impossible, and even tracking them more than a little difficult. Newer hypersonic missile technologies, like those featured in China's recently deployed DF-27, also allows these missiles to dodge and weave while tracing their trajectory at that speed, in addition to operating in different parts of the atmosphere from most existing missile defenses. These missiles fly higher than most subsonic missiles, but lower than most intercontinental ballistic missiles, which means many missile defenses simply are not optimized to strike hypersonic missiles where they travel. So that adds even more complexity to the situation, in addition to those other difficulties inherent in tracking and hitting them, mostly related to their speed. The Russian government has claimed, without providing evidence, but the claim is arguably enough with this sort of thing, that its hypersonic missiles are capable of carrying a nuclear warhead, which, if true, would change another fundamental element of the early 21st century's defense orientation, namely that all the big players are kind of capable of shooting down everyone else's stuff if they need to, at least to some degree, and that generally includes the capacity to knock down at least some nuclear-tipped missiles, if warranted. This is why nations don't just build a few nukes, they tend to aim for hundreds or thousands. It's understood that some of what they shoot will not hit the intended target, so they need to send a flurry if they want to score even a single hit. That makes the global nuke standoff a lot more precarious, because the game theory math becomes, well, if Russia can shoot a nuke at the United States or the US's allies in such a way that it cannot be knocked out of the sky, that's kind of game over. A single nuke represents a real, permanent, unavoidable, lethal threat. The US would be game theoretically incentivized then, in some cases at least, to just unload its entire nuclear arsenal on Russia before it can lob more hypersonic nukes at anyone else. There's no other rational, if brutal, response that makes sense in terms of the current state of national defense, unless you want to cede the world to the Russians. And again, this is Cold War thinking 101, but it's also an ongoing concern, as the nuclear strategy the US and Russia are still using is still largely predicated on that all-or-nothing, mutually assured destruction, we will end the world if you try to end us, Dr. Strangelove sort of math. So that in mind, these scientists have been accused of sharing hypersonic missile technologies with China at a conference in 2017. They maintained that the information they shared was freely available online and was not classified, but that may not matter. 48 Russians were convicted of treason between 2017 and 2022, many of them for sharing militarily relevant secrets with China. And though most of them contend that they are innocent, Russia does not have a functioning rule of law, so most of them have since disappeared into the system, probably either executed or sent to a gulag work camp. What I'd like to talk about today is another missile-related, nuke-focused concern, but this one more closely tied to happenings on the ground in Ukraine and the territory surrounding it. You're listening to Let's Know Things. I'm Colin Wright. A tactical nuclear weapon is a nuke that is scaled down to make it more usable, in theory at least, in battlefield conditions. What that means specifically varies based on the weapon in question, but it almost always means the nuke has been resized in terms of payload and yield so that it's just right for turning the tide of a battle, in contrast to strategic nuclear weapons, which are more likely to be used to knock out military bases or manufacturing hubs, or in some cases to just take out portions of entire cities, like the bombs that were dropped at the end of World War II on the Japanese cities Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Both of those bombs were strategic nuclear weapons. No tactical nuke, the smaller kind, has ever been used, as of the day I'm recording this, in battle. But that is mostly because we have not seen nukes used in a live conflict since those aforementioned World War II bombs were dropped. If a nuke is used at some point in the near future, it is likely to be a tactical nuke, because they are more likely to represent a step along the path toward using larger, more devastating strategic nukes. And it is hoped, at least, that everyone involved will regain some of their sanity and realize that they are toying with incredibly dangerous, maybe even civilization-ending forces at some point along that stair-step escalatory path. And because of that thinking, that tactical nukes would probably be more practical and usable than the bigger city-destroying ones, at least in terms of pessimistic but not world-ending scenarios, many of the nukes built during the Cold War fit into this category. As of 2021, it was estimated that the U.S. has about 230 tactical nuclear weapons out of a total of around 5,400 nukes, just over 1,700 of which are primed, in position, and ready to use if necessary. Russia has something like 6,000 nukes, nearly 1,600 of which are ready for deployment, and it's estimated, but not confirmed, that they have somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 tactical nuclear weapons. So the U.S. got rid of more of their tactical nukes post-Cold War than Russia, and though other nations also have nuclear weapons, we don't have any solid data on what sorts they might have built, and how many of them are prepared currently to launch at whomever they're aimed at. Though the next largest contender in terms of nuclear arsenal size is China, and it still only has a few hundred nukes, which is not nothing, but it is an order of magnitude smaller than the arsenals of the US and Russia. The more powerful strategic nuclear weapons generally boast somewhere between 100 kilotons to over a megaton in terms of yield, the power of their explosion, basically. But they do get larger than that, too. The Tsar Bomba, a thermonuclear aerial bomb that was also the most powerful weapon ever created and tested on Earth, was tested in late 1961, and it had an estimated yield of somewhere between 50 and 59 megatons. For comparison, the Fat Man and Little Boy nukes dropped on Japan had yields of around 20-ish and around 15-ish kilotons, respectively, and those destroyed substantial parts of the city they were dropped on. Tsar Bomba's low-end estimation of 50 megatons is equal to 50,000 kilotons, so about 2,500 times as powerful as the more powerful of the two, the Fat Man bomb dropped during World War II. Even wilder is that there was a version of Tsar Bomba that would have theoretically been twice as powerful, weighing in at 100 megatons. All of which is to say, we have built some just staggeringly destructive weapons, and thankfully, we mostly started pulling back from those larger yield options in the mid-20th century, recalibrating from that point for various reasons, including the aforementioned theoretical utility rationale, towards smaller, more nimble versions of the same. On the other end of the power spectrum, there's the M28 and M29 Davy Crockett, which was a US-developed system that looked a bit like a mortar or a rocket launcher that would launch a nuclear projectile with a yield of 0.02 kilotons. So far, far smaller, and only 1/1000th the potency of the Fat Man World War II bomb, but also a weapon that only weighed about 50 pounds and could be launched from the ground, maybe by a single soldier. So a lot less powerful, but still pretty powerful and small and versatile. Which again, pros and cons to that, as that versatility is part of what worries folks when we talk about tactical nukes, of which the Davy Crockett is a very low yield example. Smaller boom means more thinkable to use, and if the nuclear weapon launching taboo is ever breached, the concern is that it then becomes more thinkable for other nukes of bigger sizes and different flavors to also be launched during a conflict, even if the scale of the weapons in question are barely comparable. All of which is unfortunately newly relevant because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Not only does Russia have a bunch of tactical nukes in their arsenal, but their more conventional invasion has been flailing pretty much since day one. And concerns about potential nuke use increased still further when on March 25th, 2023, Russian President Putin announced that he would start stationing tactical nuclear weapons in neighboring Belarus after the necessary storage facility for these weapons is finished on July 1st. A couple of points about this announcement. First, there is no substantial benefit to relocating these sorts of weapons just across the border in Belarus in terms of military utility. This announcement was almost certainly meant to get folks in Kyiv, which is located not far from the Belarusian border and which is the capital of Ukraine, thinking about what such a weapon could do to their city. But Russian territory is close to Kyiv too, so this was probably mostly a psychological maneuver, not something that would substantially benefit Russia in any serious on-the-ground military way if it actually intended to nuke Ukraine. Second, it was probably also part of a larger long-term effort by Putin to pull Belarus and Belarusian President Lukashenko tighter into the Russian orbit as a younger brother sort of entity in the Russian Federation. Putin was attempting to do the same with Ukraine before its man at the top, the former Ukrainian president Yanukovych, was ousted as part of a popular uprising in 2014. So this is not entirely unexpected, and it's part of a larger pattern in which we've seen Putin being somewhat heavy-handed in leveraging his authority over Belarus, even when doing so has at times made Lukashenko look weak or ineffectual. Third, is that this tactical nuclear weapon-focused saber-rattling is not new for Putin, but it does take on additional credibility and lend additional concern when you consider Russia's parallel investments in hypersonic missile technology. There have been some reports suggesting that Ukraine has been successful in shooting down quite a few of these hypersonic missiles, which would be interesting if true, though we don't have a good unbiased source of public information and evidence of that yet, so we will see. But either way, even if these missiles are simply harder to hit, that ups the stakes in that any threat of tactical nuclear weapon usage becomes a far more likely threat vector, changing the math the US and other nuclear-armed states have to do, as again, the mutually assured destruction trigger is still fundamental to the way the world's nuke-wielding militaries function, and a first strike with even a low-yield tactical nuke could open a lot of doors that would then be incredibly difficult to shut again, and set these nations on an escalatory path that would be difficult to deviate from. And finally, Ukraine's success on the battlefield, to the point where Russian forces have been repeatedly humiliated and forced into a sort of grinding holding pattern, the only recent advances coming from paramilitary force Wagner, would seem to make it more likely that those up top in the Russian military hierarchy would be able to internally justify using nuclear weapons as a sort of last-ditch survival reflex. If they think their government will be toppled, if they think the Ukrainians and their allies are doing so well that they pose a real threat to Moscow or any other part of Russian territory, if it ever seems like the Wagner higher-ups are threatening to shatter or usurp the Russian government's authority, that could also trigger a nuclear response. One more story that popped up in international news headlines not long ago involved incursions into Russian territory from what seemed to be two Russian splinter groups who support Ukraine and who were aiming to take down Putin's government. These sorts of efforts, too, could make the hair trigger on the big red button all the more sensitive, as those at the top of such regimes often fear leaders of internal discontent more than international threats. International threats, after all, can help bring a nation together against a common enemy if you can portray that enemy appropriately. But enemies from within represent a broken unity and the potential to be overthrown in favor of another cadre that is operating from within your house is often the more pressing one for authoritarian regimes in particular, as their supporters, other folks within the government, can be pulled away by the would-be overthrower one by one. Tactical nuclear weapons, then. Although not necessarily as devastating on the battlefield as the city-destroying, mushroom-cloud-generating strategic nuclear weapons, could represent the first step up a truly horrible escalation ladder if used in real-life combat. And the situation in Ukraine is adjusting quite a few variables in such a way that the use of such weapons is becoming more likely than has been the case in a very long time. The book I'd like to recommend today is called Upgrade by Blake Crouch. This is an author that consistently produces fun, somewhat action-packed and suspenseful, typically at least, science fiction novels, and this book is no different. It delves into a world in which genetic modifications of various sort are increasingly common, but not so common that a collection of augmentations that the protagonist receives against his will and accidentally are in any way standard and common and understandable and comprehensible to the rest of society. It does what a lot of such books tend to do. It asks questions about life, about what it means to be human, about what we do when these sorts of tools emerge, something that is increasingly important in real life because these technologies are approaching a point, and in some cases already at the point, where we have to ask ourselves some very difficult questions, both in terms of applying them to other species of plants and animals, but also to ourselves. But it's also just a fun book to read, as his books tend to be. Now, if any of that sounds interesting to you, consider picking up a copy of Upgrade by Blake Crouch. You can find out more about me and my work at colin.io. You can find the show notes and transcript for this and every episode of the podcast at letsknowthings.com. You can find my other news-focused podcast at onesentencenews.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And feel free to reach out and say howdy on social media. I'm Colin Wright on Facebook and YouTube, and at Colin is my name on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you so very much for listening. I'm Colin Wright, and I'll talk to you again next week.